Welcome back to Whispers from the Prairie, your number one podcast for the history and account of paranormal activity in the Nebraska and Midwest area. We're your hosts, Sierra Decker
and Sam Muggenberg.
For this episode, we're going to dive deeper into the psychology of Jubert and the intent of his killings.
I'm not even going to try to justify it. John Jubert is more than someone who has murdered three children.
All right, so John Jubert, he was named John Jubert, or John Joseph Jubert IV, all right? And his nickname,
JJJ. It's a weird name, but
it
not
is.
Really, but really.
Yeah, I mean, three J's, like, and there was four of them.
Yeah.
This was a generational
thing. John Joseph Jubert.
That's insane to me. But anyway, mm-hmm. He was known as the Woodford Slasher.
Ooh.
He was born on July 2nd in 1963 in Lawrence, Massachusetts. However, he had an IQ, an intelligence level, of 123.
That's insane, actually.
Right. So he was known to be a good student, an honor student, actually, in school by one of his teachers.
He was a very good student in my class. He was an honor student.
However, what's really interesting, though, about that IQ range, Richard Feynman, a world-renowned theoretical physicist, he did a lot of work with quantum mechanics, and he helped a lot with particle theory. He had an IQ of 126.
Dang.
Three more.
Than John.
Than John Jubert.
Which I find strange because I feel like a lot of serial killers have a higher IQ than most people think.
Right.
Which they can probably get away with more with their killings. But
oh, certainly.
You would think that someone with a higher IQ would know that killing is wrong, but there's probably got to be some link between high IQs and needing a satisfaction to kill.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, we see this with the likes of, you know, Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
He was known to be a very, very strategic and very meticulous serial killer. And then in court, you know, he was seen as his own lawyer, which is insane.
Insane, yep.
However, Jubert, like Starkweather, had a pretty rough childhood, except this time was much more, I'd say, in the range of a trauma.
Yeah, like actual childhood trauma.
Right. At 6 years old, his parents divorced.
Oh, relatable. That doesn't make me a serial killer. I'm sorry. Like, it is relatable because my parents divorced at a young age, for me, for my brother and I, but I don't see both of us going, oh, that means murder.
Yeah, my parents divorced when I was 11.
So, yep,
now we're
young
here
age.
Making this podcast, I don't think. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think you've committed any murders.
Not to anything but little aunts.
So, Jubert moved to Portland, Maine, with his mother after his parents divorced. However, his mother was known to be very cold and manipulative.
Didn't someone say it was almost like she had him on a leash all the time?
Yes.
A very tight leash.
Yes. Now, Portland, Maine is right off the coast of Casco Bay. And growing up, he was a target for bullies. However, his teacher quoted that he never would try to defend himself. It almost felt like he thought that he deserved
this kind
bullied.
Of punishment in
right.
a way.
Right.
I mean, self-sabotage.
Now, the thing about Portland, Maine, its cost of living is about 15% higher than the average.
Ooh.
It's a pretty rough place to live. It's a very nice city with a population of around 63,000.
Dang.
However, it's pretty rough to live there. And so growing up, he spent his time pondering about murder and cannibalism.
Oh, yeah. Casually.
He fantasized about choking his babysitter to death and eating her flesh.
Oh.
Yeah.
I guess don't bite the hand that feeds you. Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
He also worked as a paperman and later joined the Boy Scouts.
Mm.
It was in the Boy Scouts that he felt inferior, and he developed very low self-esteem issues.
Oh. I wonder why. I've never been in, like, Boy Scouts. I feel like in Boy Scouts, you would usually have the opposite. You learn a lot, you grow a lot, not reverse backwards.
You would think. So I was personally in the Cub Scouts growing up.
So you would know more than I do, which is good.
Not as much as you'd think. I was there for a few years. I mean, it was quite interesting. But you learn a lot of survival skills. So I you would think that he would have thrived off of this. However, it could also be said that maybe, you know, he would take some of the training lessons in Boy Scouts more seriously than, like, his fellow comrades.
Like, this is his life and death situation for them. It's like, if I'm in a life and death situation.
Right. So
that would make more sense.
Yeah, there could have been, like, a conflict of interest between his
peers and him.
Yeah, exactly. So at 16, Jubert stabbed a 6-year-old girl with a pencil. This was his first account of leading into the serial killer territory. Jubert felt sexual gratification from the act and proceeded to do this to other innocent girls throughout Portland.
Was he ever reported for it? Like, did that first girl report him? I mean, 6-year-olds, I don't know if they know. But if she was stabbed with a pencil, that still would leave something for the parents to see. And then that would, if he kept doing it, did anyone say anything and did they know it was him?
Right.
Because, like, if this kept happening, you would think someone would be like, oh, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And if they knew it was Jubert, then they would do something about it.
You would think. You would definitely think.
I mean, looking from it, like, where we are now, it's so easy to be like, oh, why didn't this happen? Why didn't that happen? But at the time, it's actually always harder to do anything.
You know, during this time, his mom, she wasn't the best lady, right?
No. Nope.
Had him on a tight leash. So he probably was able to get away with some of this.
People thought, oh, he's supposed to be a good boy.
Right.
You know, he couldn't do anything. He's in the Boy Scouts. He's in this. His mom wouldn't let him get away with that. Yeah. But then he does.
As we know, Jubert, he grew up with a lot of childhood trauma and baggage. He had developed a superiority complex. And because he was seen as inferior and had a lot of self-confidence issues, he liked to prey on the weak and inferior to make himself feel better. You know, that's kind of an interesting coping mechanism, right?
Yeah, I mean, my coping mechanisms include sewing and crafting and listening to music, blocking out the world, cuddling all of the stuffed animals on my bed.
You're right.
Not stabbing 6-year-old girls with pencils.
Never occurred to you?
No, not even on my worst enemy.
Yeah, the sexual gratification thing, I can't get over, right? For a 6-year-old girl?
Like, and the other things that he probably did, like, how old were those girls?
Yeah.
Thinking that you get sexual gratification from hurting other people. Like, if it's consensual with your partner, maybe. Go ahead. Right. I mean, that's a you thing, not a me thing. But for innocent people, you just go around and start stabbing them or hurting them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get how you feel good about yourself after. Of course,
right,
his mind's different than mine, but still, to think about it, it doesn't make sense.
It makes absolutely no sense. You're right. I mean, a 6-year-old girl, like, that's just sickening to even think about.
Mm-hmm. At 16, too. 10
yeah.
year age difference. And he's like, yeah, no, this is great. I love this.
Yeah, I mean,
no.
Bro had no game.
No game whatsoever.
No game.
I mean, 6-year-old. Watch your 6-year-olds. God.
On August 22nd, 1982, John Jubert biked alongside 11-year-old Richard Stetson. Around this time, Jubert was 19. Jubert tried to take the boy's clothes off, and when Richard's brother was interviewed, he claimed that a chunk of his skin was bitten off.
He was strangled. He was knifed. And John took the bite out of his last calf.
Oh, my God.
a woman was on her way to work when she found the body the next morning. I mean, talk about like one of the craziest things you'll ever see on your way to work, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I mean, like whenever I'm on my way to work, like I'm just trying to get there. Like,
yep. I don't go looking around. I don't.
Yeah.
Like, where was he left? Like, what time was he taken away? What time did he stay there for until the next morning?
It's insane to think about the condition that he was left in, like,
mm-hmm.
before
I mean,
he was found.
Chunk of his skin bitten off.
It's mortifying to even think about.
Mm-hmm. I usually look for pretty flowers I can pick on my way to work or away from work.
Now, let's say she worked at McDonald's.
Oh, my gosh.
She's just on her way to the opening shift at her mm-hmm. local McDonald's, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's 11-year-old Richard Stetson just on the ground. Like, that's
traumatizing, and I would not be going into work that day or probably any day after soon.
I mean, if a customer approaches, like when you're at work during that day, if you decided to go to work.
You want some ketchup with that? Starts crying. I would. That's how I would be.
Oh, no.
Except I wouldn't work in fast food after that. I think I would be too traumatized or any kind of similar workforce after that. I don't know. That's how I would be.
I can't imagine this girl. I was thinking more along the lines of when the customer is like, you know, or when you ask the customer, hey, how's your day going?
Oh.
And then the customer's like, it's all right.
Yeah.
How was yours?
I found a dead body.
That would be insane to bring up.
Yeah. People would not believe you.
Right.
Like, they'd stand there and be like, sure. But you're like, no, I found a dead body.
Now, a year after his first murder, Joubert joined the Air Force and moved to Bellevue, Nebraska.
Oh, no.
Where he would continue his killing spree.
Now, leave us alone.
Isn't it kind of crazy that Joubert had this idea of wanting to serve his country while being at this point, just a killer, but still.
A fresh murderer. That might be a thing of his, like, self-confidence. Because, you know, being in any sort of military, like the Air Force, you are treated with respect, supposedly. You are seen as a great person for the country. People will see you as someone who's stronger. At least, that's how I feel most people see anyone in the Army or Air Force or mm-hmm. Navy or wherever it may be, whatever they may be doing, working for our country is always seen as a big positive. So him wanting to join might be part of his little self-esteem issues.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, what I'm thinking about is if he wanted to, you know, join the military, you would think that he'd join, like, the Army, where he gets to actually be more involved on, like, on-site killings and,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. So the Air Force.
What made him choose that?
It's a good question.
I wonder if anyone would know, like,
right.
when he first joined in his interview.
So his second murder was on September 18th, 1983. 13-year-old Danny Joe Epperly disappeared on his paper route for the Omaha World Herald. Epperly was found in only his underwear, tied up, and had tape all over him. His throat was cut, and there were bite marks on his body, as well as 8 stab wounds.
Holy moly. Back with the bite marks, man. Yeah. That cannibalism thing really went throughout his killings, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane that, like, he wanted this, you know, message that, like, he doesn't want to just kill his victims. He wants to leave his permanent mark.
He wants to consume them.
Yeah.
I just thought of, imagine the feeling of, like, flesh in your teeth or actual, like, a bite of someone in your teeth. That doesn't sound appealing. It does not sound appealing. I don't get it.
I don't understand how that can be appealing for someone, but jeez. Now, what's kind of funny, though, about one of the main reasons Eberle was found, folks in Omaha were complaining about missing their Omaha World Herald papers. And so when that stirred up, then they're like, oh, shit, a paper boy's gone.
Yeah, like, oh, where's my paper? Where's the paper boy?
Yeah.
Dang.
Everyone asks, where is the paper boy? Not how is the paper boy?
Oh, no. The paper boy is gone.
No. Joubert was also a paper boy in Portland. So I wonder if there's some sort of connection that he had with wanting to murder a paper boy. We know that Joubert had an inferiority complex, right?
Yes.
It would not be far off to assume that he could have seen, like, a past version of himself in Eberle. And because of his eternal self-hatred and his superiority complex, acting on that could easily have been a reason.
Yeah, seeing him and going, oh, that's a problem. I see myself. I need to get rid of that.
Now, on December 2nd, 1983, which was about 11 weeks after Eberle went missing, Joubert killed 12-year-old Christopher Paul Walden when he was walking to school. So Walden was found 3 days later after he was murdered by a pheasant hunter. His throat was slashed, and his body was horrifically mutilated.
While the body was lying there frozen, his books and his knapsack and all his belongings were stacked there. So if you can imagine someone making you take your clothes off with just your shorts on and walking in the snow, and then making you lie down in the snow, you got the knife held at your throat and there's nowhere to go, and he's overpowering you, knowing that you're going to be killed, it would have to be a terrible, terrible feeling for a little boy to go through.
There was little information on this case that the police could identify. It was a pretty closed case, and there was not a lot of speculations before Joubert was found.
I mean, horrifically mutilated, sat there for 3 days. Like, I mean, I was surprised of, in the state, someone finding your body one morning after. But three days?
No, that's insane.
I wonder where he had him. And it's actually really interesting. My mom's boyfriend, TJ, was very young when all of this went down. And he grew up in the same area that the third boy went missing. I talked with him because my mom told me that he had said something about it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to talk to TJ. So I did. And I said, hey, what was your experience with John Joubert, like the whole incident? And his face dropped. Like hearing his voice talk about it, it was not pleasant. He had talked about when Eberle went missing, every time he walked home from school, the moms of the neighborhood would call each other saying, hey, TJ just walked down this street, he's heading this way. So then the next mom, if he didn't see TJ walk down, they would know. And it was weird because apparently one of those days, TJ was being followed by a car. And the moms were very concerned. I mean, all of this is going down. Kid being followed by a strange car. They called the police. The police went to the car. Turned out it was the FBI, like, following him to make sure they could watch and see if anything happened. Which is really interesting that they were on the case, like, watching kids, but they didn't let anyone know, which, I mean, makes sense. They don't want it to be public. So whoever was taking the kids would know not to take the kids when they're being followed. But it was interesting hearing how the moms and the parents of the community came together to be like, we gotta watch our kids. We can't let them walk alone. We have to keep our eyes on them.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's compelling.
He told me, I can take you to where they caught him. Like, I know all of the places. I know where it went down. I could drive you around that area. And I'm really wanting him to drive me around that area. I mean, growing up with that happening around you, you're like the same age as the kids that are going missing. It's around your school. It's around your place. How are you supposed to feel? You're not, I mean, school nowadays doesn't feel safe for other reasons.
Right.
School then, not feeling safe for that, that would be way worse.
Yeah, I could not even imagine. When I was in elementary, we had a, not an active shooter, but someone came by and it was said later that he had a firearm on him. No one got hurt. However, we were forced to be on a lockdown. And I could hear, like, you know, there was exasperation in my principal's voice over the intercom. And that, I think it was like when I was in fourth, fifth grade, it was traumatizing.
Knowing dangers outside.
Right. Like, I couldn't even begin to imagine what that would be like on the scale of this was like an everyday thing for however long.
Walking home, watching your back, knowing something's going on, but you don't know who yet, you don't know what.
Yeah, that's insane.
Scary.
It really is. So, on January 11th, 1984, roughly a month after his last killing, a church preschool director spotted Joubert's car. Joubert approached the director and asked her for directions to another street, and then asked her for a phone to use.
However, so, not suspicious at all.
Not at all. The teacher said no. So Joubert threatened her and tried to push her inside the building, but she managed to get past him and ran.
And these serial killers, the big thing in their procedure is control. And you've got to break that concentration of control. Mrs. Weaver did that.
Instincts, survival instincts. You know something's wrong and you get out of there.
Oh, yeah. The director wrote down the license plate because she was already suspicious of him.
Yeah, I mean, even if it isn't who you may think it is, that's not good in general. You're going to take it to the police.
Right, exactly. And brought the license plate, because she wrote down the license plate. She brought that to the Bellevue police. And they found rope in his duffel bag that matched the one that Eberle was tied with. You would think that he'd get rid of that.
Yeah, I mean, evidence. I mean, he was probably planning for another one.
Oh, using the same rope? Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't caught for anything yet. Why change?
Exactly. Yeah, having that mindset of, you know, I'm not caught yet. What's stopping me? Like,
this isn't going to get me in trouble. I don't need to get a different type of rope.
Yeah. Joubert was asked in an interview if he considered the death penalty when he moved to Nebraska, because in Maine, they don't do capital punishment, or at least back then they didn't.
Yeah.
His response, no, I never did. I mean, when I first came to Nebraska, I never thought about committing any crimes. Once I did, I never thought about getting caught either. I wasn't able to think beyond acting out the obsession.
It's weird how he says, I wasn't thinking about committing crimes after he already done one in Maine. Maybe he was like, it's a one-time thing. I'm moving away. I won't be caught. It will be fine. But then that festered in him, and he wanted more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he got that insatiable relief from, you know, what he was doing to those six-year-old girls. And then thinking about, you know, his babysitter growing up, and then his first murder in Portland, like, all of that probably made him feel, you know, a sense of euphoria, which is so chilling to think about.
And then he's like, oh, I'll go to Nebraska. I wasn't thinking about doing it, but it happened because I can't stop myself.
Yeah. Now, Joubert also said,
the murders provided material for the violent fantasies. That's all of the gratification it was. and I can't do anything except apologize. Oh, and I am sorry. And it shouldn't have happened.
Material for his fantasies.
Yeah.
Play video games.
Actually.
Like, don't... Oh, that... Ugh, that actually... Ugh.
I know.
I don't know how to other... I don't know what to say about that. It is just... repulsing.
It is insane to think about. Jubert claimed that he was grateful that he got caught and was asked if he would have killed again if he had the chance. That's my big worry. It's scaring me quite a bit. Yes, was his response.
So he was grateful he was caught and knew he would have kept doing it.
Yep.
Oh, God.
Insane.
Like, you can, with what he's saying, it's like, oh, you know he knows what he's doing is bad.
Right.
But you can't stop yourself. Oh. Imagine not being able to stop. It's an addiction. It's quite literally an addiction. Just the worst kind of addiction. Hurting others, not just yourself.
Yeah. No, it's... doing it's one thing, and then doing it again is another, and then again, and then realizing that I've already done this once, I've already done this twice, I've already done this thrice. I could keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And even when being caught, saying, oh no, I'd love to do this again. That is...
Oh.
Chilling.
Mm-hmm.
So on October 15th, 1990, Jubert was convicted for the murder of Richard Stetson, the boy in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, all three of his murders were now linked back to him. And luckily, at 12:29 a.m. on July 17th, 1996, Jubert was executed via the electric chair.
Shocking justice, but not shocking at all. Yes.
Right. I mean, he had it coming.
Mm-hmm. Good thing for Nebraska justice systems there.
So while he was waiting on death row, KETV reporters interviewed Jubert, and he claimed to be pleading for his life and begged to not receive the death penalty.
I said to him, you know, here you are, pleading for your life, and all these years ago these boys pleaded to you for their lives and you didn't listen to them. Why should we listen to you now? And his answer was, because you're not me, you're not killers.
What did he mean by that? What?
It's so cryptic.
You wouldn't, is it, you're not me, you wouldn't understand.
You wouldn't understand. Yeah, that's what I
oh God.
I mean, oh jeez.
You're not me, you're not killers. And recently, actually, a monument was built for the two boys from Nebraska. It's in front of the Sarpy County Administration Building in Papillion. It started as a fundraiser to provide grants to families of crime victims. I want to go visit it sometime.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Go pay respects for the kids. I mean, we're talking about them now, and what they went through is nothing good. So...
yeah. It's good for, you know, the Sarpy County Administration to pay homage in that way.
Mm-hmm. And fundraise, because if it was just a little monument, then, yeah, people can pay the respects. But if people want to go help, there's a fundraiser. Help those families.
Yeah. Now, let's try to dive a little bit deeper into the analysis of Jubert. John Jubert, he had a lot of self-confidence issues growing up, right?
Yeah.
He had a high IQ and a very troubled childhood.
You know, divorced parents, strict mom, bullied, probably intense bullying, if we think about it. Not just, you know, ha-ha loser, walk in the hallway. Like, something's got to be really bad bullying for something like that to happen.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that, you know, he had this sort of vengeance in his mind. He wanted to show the world that he was, like, a threat.
He's like, I deserve this, but I can't be like this. That's interesting.
It's like he waited. He was, ever since that day, he, in his head, was formulating some sort of plan to
get back at the world.
Exactly.
And of course, choosing innocent kids as his outlet.
But there's still one thing that just kind of bothers me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were there more murders?
Oh.
So, Jubert, at age 16, he went on his little pencil stabbing spree of little girls.
And yeah.
Fantasized about murdering and cannibalizing his female babysitter. The trend here, girls, right?
Yeah.
The three murders that he was convicted of were all little boys.
Oh.
It doesn't match the narrative or the MO of preying, or it does match the MO of preying on the weak and powerless.
Yeah.
However, he also was given sexual gratification from women and doing awful things to these women.
Mm-hmm.
So, it might be fair to assume that he could have either essayed or murdered young girls while he was alive.
I don't know how bad the last kid's body was mutilated, because it said it was mutilated.
Right.
How bad does that mean? Because I feel like could have possibly been the bite marks, though, biting into the kids. So if there were ever, like, more instances of finding bodies that don't have someone to tie them to, could he still have had that MO? Because if he didn't have it for the last kid, maybe that wasn't his MO. That would be within every single murder.
Right.
Which would be, I mean, he's already dead now, so it's not like we can hurt him in any way, but still have something for those who were his victims.
Yeah, no, it definitely could be that case, right? Like, there could have been other murders. There could have been other victims, like you said, if they're not tied to someone. What's stopping anyone from thinking Jubert had his hands and teeth on them?
Yeah.
But he claimed that he would have killed again if he was given the chance.
Mm-hmm.
And that could have been some sort of cryptic message telling the world that there may be something lying hidden like a whisper in the prairie. Well, thank you for listening to the second episode of Whispers from the Prairie. We hope that you've enjoyed your time with us. Remember that we upload our episodes on the Karen YouTube website. However, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our next episode will cover Temple Theater, one of Nebraska's most haunted buildings here on the University of Nebraska-Lincoln campus. Be on the lookout for that, and we will also be taking requests for any paranormal activity stories that you listeners have or want us to explore. You can find our contact information on the Karen YouTube website. Thank you.
See you next time.